Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights and Litigation Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, September 16, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing the EPA and its Waters of the U.S. rule. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome our expert today, a single expert, Mr. Michael Park. He's a partner at Consovoy McCarthy Park, the law firm right here in the Washington, D.C. area. He's involved in a case that involves this rule, so we're very anxious to hear from him. With that, welcome, and the floor is yours, Mr. Park.
Thank you, Dean. It's a privilege to be able to talk about a case that I've been working on recently. It's both interesting and important, involving the Waters of the United States rule, WOTUS for short. I'm sure people have heard of POTUS and SCOTUS and maybe FLOTUS, but this is Waters, things that end in of the United States. So the WOTUS rule is a rule by the EPA that went into effect earlier this summer. That expands the definition of the term waters in the United States in a way that increases the federal government's authority, in particular the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, and has spawned a fair amount of litigation. I guess I should do the disclaimer here and note that I'm speaking only for myself, not my firm, certainly not my clients, so please attribute any stupid things I may say to me personally. I thought that we would walk through some background on the Clean Water Act, the Supreme Court cases that are relevant. There's only a handful of them. And then get into the rule and then describe the current status of the litigation, which is itself pretty complicated. I guess at this point, if you haven't already, now's a good time to hit mute and put your head down or grab your lunch or whatever. The Clean Water Act, as we know it today, was passed in 1972. Its objective is to, quote, restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters, i.e. to stop pollution of the waters. And it gives federal agencies, in particular the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, and I'll refer to them generally as the agencies, the authority to regulate what's called navigable waters, which is then defined as waters of the United States. And that's the phrase that we're going to be focusing on in respect to this rule. In 1983, the agency has promulgated a rule defining this phrase, waters of the United States, to consist of waters used in interstate commerce, other waters that affect interstate commerce, like intrastate lakes, rivers, and streams, impoundments, tributaries, the territorial sea, and wetlands. Since then, the Supreme Court has addressed the scope of the rule three times, and two of those times striking down the agency's attempts to enforce the rule. So the first case is from 1985. It's United States versus Riverside Bayview Homes, and the court reviewed whether the Army Corps had properly classified as a water of the United States, a Michigan wetland that was, quote, characterized by saturated soil conditions and wetland vegetation that extended beyond the boundary of respondents' property to a navigable waterway. And the court found that the jurisdiction of the Army Corps was reasonable because the property was actually part of a wetland that abuts on a navigable waterway. So you're starting to see from this case already the tension between what is actually navigable water and, you know, what is adjacent to that or abuts that type of water that also would fall within the scope of the rule. And the court upheld that. Then, 16 years later in 2001, in Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County versus Army Corps of Engineers, SWANC, I think is the acronym, the court held that the Clean Water Act didn't give the court jurisdiction to regulate an abandoned sand and gravel pit in northern Illinois. And this case had to do with what's known as the migratory bird rule. which was it had to do with the fact that this pit in Illinois provided a habitat for migratory birds. And the court there said, no, Congress didn't authorize agencies to regulate, quote, non-navigable, isolated intrastate waters, such as seasonal ponds where these birds would come and hang out. So the court concluded that the agencies couldn't regulate these waters because they're isolated and it would push Congress's power to sort of the outer extreme and have the effect of, quote, altering the federal-state framework by permitting federal encroachment upon a traditional state power, end quote, and raise significant constitutional questions about the Clean Water Act. And that's a theme that we're going to get back to in this WOTUS rule litigation, which is the balance between what's traditionally considered state jurisdiction versus what the federal government has been trying to take upon itself through the redefinition of the waters of the United States. And then most recently, in 2006, is the Rapanos versus United States case, in which the Supreme Court rejected an Army Corps assertion of jurisdiction over Michigan wetlands that were, quote, near ditches or man-made drains that eventually emptied into traditional navigable waters, end quote. So what you've got there is that there are lands that aren't what you consider traditional navigable waters, but they interact with them. And there, Justice Scalia, who wrote for a plurality, four justices, found that there was no jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act because the phrase waters of the United States includes only, quote, those relatively permanent bodies of water connected to traditional interstate navigable waters, end quote, and two, waters with a continuous surface connection to such permanent waters. So the issue really is how close is the connection between the land that the EPA is trying to regulate and what are actually considered navigable waters. And the plurality held the waters of the United States did not include channels through which the water flows intermittently or ephemerally or periodically provide drainage for rainfall. In this Rapanos case, Justice Kennedy wrote separately in concurrence, and he found that there was no jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act over the wetlands, but his reasoning was slightly different. He said that the waters of the United States include those waters that are navigable in fact, or that could be reasonably made so, or waters with a, quote, significant nexus to such navigable waters. And that phrase is going to become very important because the significant nexus test now is what has become operative in the EPA to determine whether a water is in fact a water of the United States. And to have a significant nexus, just as Kennedy said, the water must significantly affect the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of those waters, more readily understood as navigable. After Rapanos in 2006, the agencies issued guidance explaining that this was the approach that the agencies would use to determine whether waters would be subject to the Clean Water Act post-Rapanos. And so they then determined that the jurisdictional issues would be appropriate through rulemaking that would be dictated by the terms of Rapanos and subject to this significant nexus test. So fast forward to 2015, the WOTUS rule. June 29th is when the agencies adopted the rule, and it basically is an attempt to expand the phrase waters of the United States. And it does so in three ways. One, it adds a new category of waters that are, quote, adjacent to primary waters that include neighboring waters within certain specified distances. Two, it adds a new category of waters that are within certain distances of primary waters if they have a significant nexus to primary water. And then three, it redefines tributaries in a way that expands federal jurisdictions to include streams that, as a matter of fact, are dry for most of the year, but it the redefinition of tributaries encompasses these lands. The agencies noted that the expansion of the rule was a definitional one, and it didn't directly establish any new regulatory requirements. And this will become important when we discuss the Sixth Circuit litigation a little bit later. Shortly after promulgation of the final rule, a number of plaintiffs, several dozen of states, trade associations, and other private plaintiffs filed lawsuits around the country alleging that this rule exceeded the agency's legal authority under various theories, including violations of the Clean Water Act, the Administrative Procedure Act, the Regulatory Flexibility Act, and the U.S. Constitution, both the Commerce Clause and federalism principles. And the theory there is that, you know, dozens of industries are going to be affected by the rule: manufacturing, mining, asphalt, food, pulp and paper, paint manufacturing, electricity, energy development, water utilities, sand, stone, gravel operations, road construction, landfills, real estate, railroads, industrial development, agriculture, a whole host of industries that have lands where water now may sit on their land and be classified as waters of the United States, may subject them to expensive and burdensome federal regulation that would be new to them, could impose costs, it could change their plans for what they want to do with their land. There's a whole host of uncertainty as to the impact and scope of the rule, but it appears to be something that will impact a huge number of industries and companies. And so that spawned a bunch of litigation across the country. In particular, plaintiffs filed 14 cases in district courts across the country challenging the rule. 11 of them have been stayed pending JPML judicial panel multi-district litigation decision, which I'll get to in a little bit. Two of them in Georgia and West Virginia have had preliminary injunctions that were denied for lack of jurisdiction. One case in North Dakota granted preliminary injunction, basically staying enforcement of the rule in 13 states that filed a complaint. And then there's been one complaint or one appeal that has been taken to the 11th Circuit out of Georgia. So within just a few months, there have been over a dozen different actions that have been filed going in various different directions. Which leads me to, I guess, the current litigation status. There's two basic fronts there. One is the JPML, like I mentioned. On October 1, the JPML is going to hear argument on the agency's motions to transfer and consolidate. The EPA and the Army Corps asked for transfer and consolidation of all the various cases to the District of Columbia, basically because it's a convenient place to be and DC is good for administrative law or something like that. And now they've recently added the state of Ohio, given that the appeals process is in the Sixth Circuit, which I'll get to in a moment. The states and private plaintiffs have argued that states should be, that the cases should be heard where they were brought, because plaintiffs get to choose their forums and they raise individualized factual issues, and that the only common issues are legal ones. And that's not typically what the JPML process is for. In the alternative, plaintiffs ask for Georgia or North Dakota as the courts in which the litigation has gotten the most advanced, having addressed preliminary injunction issues, and therefore where transfer and consolidation would make the most sense. And then DC and Ohio have no cases pending. So that's coming up in October. And then the other current active front, I guess, is the Sixth Circuit, where for these petitions for review, which is what they're called, a group of 18 states has moved for dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The petitions for review were all drawn by lottery in the Sixth Circuit, and the states just last week moved to dismiss, saying that there is no subject matter jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act provides for 7 specific categories of disputes where the appellate courts get jurisdiction, and in particular here, the question is whether whether the WOTUS rule promulgates an effluent limitation or an issuance or denial of a permit, and the plaintiffs are arguing that no, it doesn't. It's definitional, but the EPA is saying no. Changing the scope of the rule affects effluent limitations and permits as well. So that is now on appeal in the Sixth Circuit, which just issued this morning a scheduling order, which I think will take briefing out into November. And the JPML hearing oral argument, I think I mentioned, was in October 1. So those are the two current places where there's issues pending. There's also, finally, I think 11th Circuit appeal that's been noticed challenging the denial of the Georgia courts, of the preliminary injunction in the Georgia court, but I don't think a briefing schedule has been set there. So this really is a nationwide litigation, just tons of layers of issues and federal jurisdictional questions and, you know, developments happening every day. Of course, underlying that is an important issue that affects businesses and small and large businesses in their day-to-day operations and business activities. So it's something that we're working on and watching very closely.
Very good. Let's check in with the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to ask a question of our expert. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, I need you to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. While we wait to see if anyone rings in, let me make a quick announcement about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. That's Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be talking about implementation of the Obergefell case, the gay marriage case. That's 1 p.m. Friday Eastern Time. Next week, we have a robust schedule of Teleforum conference calls with a call scheduled at this point for every day. For details, check the Federalist Society's website or just Google Federalist Society Teleforum and you'll get to the right page. Today, if you have a question on the Clean Water Act or the Waters of the U.S. rule and the litigation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. Let's check in with our first caller now.
Hi, Michael. This is Dick Stoll. Do you have a view on whether there is jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals right now for this rule? I mean, when you read those 7 different things that could get you into 509, do you think WOTUS is one of those 7 things?
Well, so that's an issue that's being litigated. The states filed that motion to dismiss. So it's pending, and I don't want to speak to the positions of various plaintiffs on that. Our position, I think, will be that the original jurisdiction belongs in the district courts, because the 7 categories are pretty narrowly defined, and you know, changing the definition of what counts as waters doesn't seem to be directly regulating effluent limitations or permits.
I would agree with that. I'm not in that litigation, but I have a hard time reading those 7 and finding the WOTUS rule as being one of those 7. It's just really hard to do.
There's definitely a slippery slope. I think it could open up appellate jurisdiction to a whole host of things that would affect those 7 categories as opposed to directly regulate the 7 categories.
Yep.
Michael, this is Dean Reuter. When you during your opening remarks, I thought I understood you to say that the EPA, when it promulgated this regulation, characterized it as a redefinition with no new regulatory requirements. Is that correct or not?
That's correct. In the definitions, it said it is a definitional rulemaking and not a direct regulation of other aspects of the waters of the United States. And so that's something that I think the is in the briefing. I don't know if the EPA's characterization of their rule, though, is enough to make the argument that as to what it is or isn't.
But they're taking a position contrary to that in litigation in the Sixth Circuit case. Is that right?
I would argue that. I don't know if they would agree with that characterization, but yes.
Okay. No, I understand. And I should have said at the outset, obviously, this is ongoing litigation, so our guest might be limited in some respects in what he can say. But do ask your questions, and he will answer them to the extent he can. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, so let's take another call at this point. Caller, you might be on mute. If you muted your own telephone, you need to come off mute. We can't hear you.
Muted. Is this the same EPA that dumped millions of gallons of toxic waste from a mine out west into a river? These are the experts who's supposed to defer to?
That sounds like a rhetorical question, but you can answer that, Mr. Park. Or respond.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I don't know how to work that into this litigation. I don't know if it's specifically relevant, but I have seen those stories as well. Yeah, the EPA has been engaged in a variety of litigation, and this is just one aspect of that. So,
I've heard of them deliberately mixing toxic chemicals that were safely stored in a 55-gallon drum until it fumed and the fire department had to be called. I've heard them dumping chrome down the drain and just deliberately. We're the EPA. We can do that.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got another question pending, but after that, it looks like our lines are open. Push the star button, then the pound button. Let's take another call.
Yeah, this is Brad Smith out in Michigan, representing some agricultural interests. And I'm a little confused on the district court's injunction, preliminary injunction. I think it's South Dakota. And then I've heard statements that preliminary injunction covers 13 states, and I was wondering if Michael could explain why a district court preliminary injunction would be construed to cover 13 states.
Yeah, that's in North Dakota. 13 states were the plaintiffs in that particular lawsuit. The court there granted their motion for preliminary injunction, staying enforcement of the rule, and then asked for supplemental briefing on the question whether the injunction should apply nationally, and the court decided that it should not. And the history there was that following the original preliminary injunction order, the EPA released a statement saying that it intended to enforce the rule in all the other states, the other 37 states in the country, and the court asked for briefing on whether the injunction should apply nationwide or just to the parties before it. And it limited its ruling to the 13 states that filed suit in North Dakota. So that is the current lay of the land. And it's an awkward situation, I think, for the EPA, particularly going into the JPML situation where part of the country has the rule in effect and part of it has it stayed. It's an interesting I'm not sure how it's going to play out in practice.
So is that the Eighth Circuit? I mean, have they appealed it to the Eighth Circuit?
Not that I know of. I don't believe that there's been an appeal in the Eighth Circuit. I think it's just so far the North Dakota injunction.
Okay, thanks.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open now. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me ask you, well, here we do have a caller, so I will defer to the audience now and carry on with our questions.
Hi, this is Carolyn Parlato. I wondered, when the EPA promulgated this definitional change, did they put a cost number on it? Did they quantify it?
So was there a cost-benefit analysis, and if so, what did that look like, Mr. Park?
So one of our arguments is that they didn't comply with the Regulatory Flexibility Act, which requires precisely that type of analysis with regard to the effect that a regulation will have on small businesses. I don't know to what extent that it did do studies. Our argument would be that it was insufficient, but I think that's all in the record that we'll have to get into during the litigation on the merits.
It just seems to me the cost to this is enormous. I mean, it's probably unquantifiable, but every rivulet and puddle in the United States essentially would need to be litigated. So the cost is huge.
Right. So the EPA's estimate was, I think the upper end was roughly 4% of land. There would be a 4% increase in land that would be covered by this rule. I think there's, you know, that's factually disputed. And there'll have to be further studies on, you know, what actually it encompasses, because there's very specific parameters on, you know, when the water was last there, how high it went, and, you know, what counts now as waters in the United States. And so that's going to be a factual issue that is probably going to be disputed by experts.
Thank you.
You mentioned also, well, once again, let me call for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question while we're waiting to see who else rings in. You mentioned an APA argument. Is that a notice and comment argument? And if this was, you know, promulgated or passed as a redefinition with no new regulatory requirements, did they follow the APA? Did they follow notice and comment?
Yeah, so it's actually both notice and comment and arbitrary and capricious. So on the notice and comment issue, the argument is that what they described as what the regulation would do turned out to be different than what was actually promulgated in June. And then the arbitrary and capricious argument is a separate one, saying that there's no real rational basis for what they had done. So there's two separate APA claims.
Can you say more about how the initial rule, a publicized rule, differed from the final? What are the arguments there?
No, I need to go look at that. I don't have that off the top
okay.
of my head.
Fair enough. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got another caller, so let's return to our callers now.
Yeah, hi. This is Dave from Nevada. I believe we're one of the 13 states that the stay is in place in. But my question had to do with this idea of the significant nexus of the waters. And all the discussion has been over surface waters, wetlands, tributaries, those types of things. But I'm curious, the Bureau of Reclamation has been pursuing certain litigation in some states, some western states, where they're trying to assert control over groundwater based on the hydrologic connectivity of the groundwater to certain rivers and tributaries and those types of things. Is that at play in here? Is the significant nexus, would it include, based on hydrologic connectivity, control over groundwater resources as well?
So, Dave, that sounds way more technical than I understand. I know that the significant nexus test it basically turns on whether the water significantly affects the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of what's traditionally understood as navigable waters. So I don't know about, you know, specifically how hydrologic technology would affect traditional waters, but that's sort of the test. And that may be, that may well be a factual question that we have to get into during litigation.
Again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your phone. Our lines are wide open at this point. And once again, while we're waiting, let me ask you if you have some sense of what the road forward looks like. Does this case ultimately end up in the Supreme Court, or any predictions you want to venture in that regard? What's next?
Yeah, that's a good question. It seems almost every day there is a new development in this case, both on the appellate and at the district court levels. I would think that this is the type of case that ultimately will be something that the Supreme Court takes an interest in. Of course, that depends on how courts come out in litigation in the meantime. But it's there's various issues on the merits and on the jurisdictional issue that are difficult legal questions and on which courts may well disagree. So at this point, I think the plaintiffs would like to have their cases heard in the case, in the courts where they brought them on the merits, and have courts determine that the rule is affecting their businesses and just the operation of their lands and the things that they have to do to comply with federal requirements, even though it's what they are doing is not traditionally understood as, you know, regulating waters. But I think it'll really depend on how the litigation advances. So right now, I guess it's just a day at a time, really.
Okay. Let me make a final call for questions. If anybody has a question, now's the time. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Okay. Let me check back in with our guests, see if you have a final thought or you want to wrap up or say anything by way of concluding remark before we adjourn. Well, hold that for a moment. We do have another question from the audience. So since we have some more time left, let's check in with the audience again.
Is this a new occurrence, or EPA is enforcing regulations in some states and not other states, or has this happened before?
You mean with respect to the North Dakota injunction?
Yes.
That seems unusual to me. I don't know the history of whether they have moved forward with enforcement in certain states where a rule is enjoined in others. That certainly strikes me as unusual, but I'm not in a position to say whether it's unprecedented. I just don't know the answer to that.
Thank you.
I do recall that I think the president announced that the Alaska power plants would be exempt from the from EPA's carbon rules, but of course, the 13 states that are exempt from this rule are exempt by court order.
Correct.
Okay. Any final thoughts, Mr. Park?
No. Well, thank you all for listening in. This is a really interesting case, and I'm sure there will be more developments that are coming over the next few weeks and months. Like I mentioned, the JPML and the Sixth Circuit and possibly 11th Circuit are weighing in. We have this unusual situation, which the last caller just pointed out, where we have an injunction in a fourth of the country and not the rest of it. And so this is a highly unstable area of the law right now, and we're looking forward to seeing where it goes.
It's an interesting set of circumstances, and I hope you'll be able to join us in the future as things continue to develop on this front. Thank you to our guest, Mr. Michael Park, and his law firm, Consovoy Law Firm, here in Washington, D.C. We appreciate you appearing and taking the time to join us here today. I want to thank the audience as well for joining us and for your questions. And a reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.